Chapter 10. The Istuli Plains. A quote from Aquinas I, 44 Epistles. There is morality, and there is cowardice. The two are not to be confused, even though in appearance and effect they are so often the same. A quote from Zarathinius, a defense of the arcane arts. If the gods did not pretend to be human, men would recoil from them as from spiders. Late Spring, 20, New Imperial Year, 4132, Year of the Tusk. The High Istuli. The shadows of missing things are always cold, and for Verrilt Sorwheel so very much was missing. Like the way his mother would read to him in bed, or how his father would pretend to lose finger fights to him. Like laughter, or hope. Loss is at once memory. That is the kernel of its power. If you were to lose the memory with the person, the way Aeschylus had said non-men lose, then loss would be complete, utter, and we would carry on oblivious. But no. The pain dwells in the balance of loss and retention, in losing and knowing what was lost, in being two incommensurate people, one with a father and mother, and one without. One with pride and honor, and one without. So the old him had continued to come up with jokes, questions, and observations to share with his father. Harweel had talked often with his son, while the new him, the orphan, would shiver, teeter, inner fingers groping for lost handholds. And that recognition, the crashing, all-encompassing cold, would strike him as if for the first time. Your father is dead. Your people are slaves. You are alone, a captive in the host of your enemy. But the paradox, some would say tragedy, of human existence, is that we so easily raise our lives about absence. We are bred for it. Men forever counting their losses, hoarding them. There is meaning to be found in victimization, and no small justification. To be wronged is to be owed. To walk among debtors wherever you go. But now, even that embittered and self-righteous persona was missing. That boy. Sorwheel awoke tangled in fragmentary glimpses of the previous night. The last frantic moments with Aeschylus, stranded at the very gut of hell. The face of Serwa, hanging above a world painted in light and the shadows of spitting, gibbering violence. Then Zaranga's dark and handsome face, smiling in haggard joy. "You took a knock on the head, Horse King. Good thing you have more skull than brain." White-weathered canvas framed the successor prince with dull brilliance. Sorwheel raised a hand as if to block out the sight of him, tried to say something snide, but choked on his own throat instead. His entire body buzzed with the deprivations of the previous weeks. He felt like a wineskin squeezed to its final pulpy dregs. The alarm, when it came, wrenched him upright. The horde. The ordeal. Aeschylus. "Ho!" Zaranga cried, nearly toppling backward from his stool. Sorwheel glanced about the stifling confines of his tent, glaring with the urgent stupor of those worried they still dream. The canvas plains glowed with heat. The entrance flap wagged in the breeze, revealing a sliver of baked earth. Porsperian huddled in the corner next to the threshold, watching with a look that was at once wary and forlorn. "Your slave," Zaranga said, with a dark look at the Shigeki. "I fear I tried to beat the truth out of him." Sorwheel tried to focus on his friend, felt his eyes bulge for the effort. Something malodorous hung in the air, a smell he had breathed too long to identify. "And," he managed to cough, "the wretch fears powers greater than me." The young king of Sarkarpus rubbed his eyes and face, lowered his hands to consider the blood worn into the whorls of his palms. "The others?" he asked roughly. "What happened to the others?" The question snuffed what remained of his friend's hilarity. Zaranga explained how he and the others had continued riding hard for General Cayutus, how the treachery of the ground and fugitive exhaustion pulled them down one by one. Captain Harnalus was the first to fall. A burst heart, Saranga assumed, given the way his pony had seized mid-stride. He never saw what became of Zing. Only he, Tinurit, and four others managed to outdistance the 10 yoke legion, only to be assailed by more Shrank, these from the Horde. That was when the Longbeard saved us, he said, his voice limping about his disbelief. Sodanyani knights. Agmundermen, I think they were. So we regarded his friend in the silence that followed. Zaranga no longer wore the crimson tunic and golden cuirass of a Kidrahil officer. He had donned, rather, the apparel and regalia of his native Zeum, a battle sash cinching a jaguar skin kilt, and a wig consisting of innumerable oiled ringlets, symbolic of something, Sorwheel imagined. The fabric and accoutrements seemed almost absurdly clean and unused, entirely at odds with the starved, battered, and unwashed form they clothed. "What about those we left behind?" Sorwheel asked. "What about Obutegwa?" "Nothing. But perhaps that's for the best." The young king wanted to ask what he meant, but it seemed more important to ignore the man's tears. "The Scions are no more, Sorwheel. We are all dead." They both paused to ruminate. The bindings of the tent complained in a mellow wind. The clamor of the camp seemed to wax and wane with its breezy pulses, as if the sky were a glass that alternately blurred and focused the world's sound. "And Aeschylus?" Sorwheel asked, realizing he had only assumed his tutor's survival. "What about him?" Saranga scowled. "He's a fat man in times of famine." "What?" "A Zeumi proverb. It means men like him never die." Sorwheel pursed a thoughtful lip, winced at a sudden pain lancing through his sinuses. "Even though they should..." Saranga dropped his gaze, as if regretting glib words, then looked up with a helpless smile. "Zeumi proverbs tend to be harsh," he said. "We have always preferred the wisdom that cracks heads." Sorwheel snorted and grinned, only to find himself tangled in recriminations of his own. So many dead. Friends. Comrades. It seemed obscene that he should feel amusement, let alone relief and gratification. For weeks they had strived, warred against distance and frailty to accomplish a mortal mission. They had faltered, and they had feared. But they had persevered. They had won, and despite the grievous proportions of the toll exacted, that fact cried out with its own demented jubilation. The Scions had died in glory. Undying glory. What was a life of bickering and whoring compared with such a death? Zaranga did not share his celebratory sentiment. "Those who fell," Sorwheel said in the tentative way of friends hoping to balm guessed-at pains. "Few are so lucky, Zaranga. Truly." But even as he spoke, the young king understood he had guessed wrong. The successor prince did not grieve those who had fallen. He grieved his own survival, or the manner of it. "There is another saying," Saranga said with uncharacteristic hesitancy. "Another proverb that you need to know."
"Yes?"
The successor prince leveled his gaze. "Courage casts the longest shadow." Sorwheel nodded.
"And what does that mean?"
Saranga flashed him the impatient look people give when called upon to elaborate embarrassing admissions. "We Zeumi are a people of deeds," he said on a heavy breath. "We live to honor our dead fathers with wisdom in the court, valor in the field."
"The back door to the heavenly palace," Sorwheel interrupted, recalling the man's explanation of Zeumi religion as a kind of spiritual influence peddling. "I remember."
"Yes, exactly. The saying means that the courage of one man is the shame of the other." He pursed his fulsome lips. "And you, Horse King, what you did." The night, the dark, the flurry of passion and dim detail came back to Sorwheel. He remembered crying out to his friend the instant after Aeschylus crashed to earth.
"Are you saying I shamed you?"
A dour grin. "In the eyes of my ancestors, most certainly." Sorwheel shook his head in disbelief.
I apologize. Maybe if you're lucky they'll smuggle you in the slave entrance.
The successor prince scowled. It was a thing of wonder, what you did, he said with disconcerting intensity. I saw you, Horse King. I know you called to me. And yet, I rode on.
He glared like someone speaking against a mob of baser instincts.
I will be forever finding my way out from your shadow.
Sowheel flinched from the look. His eyes settled on Porsperian, where he sat humbled and huddled in the airy gray light.
Time to seek the company of cowards, he offered weakly.
The longest shadow, remember?
Saranga said, with an air of someone humiliated for his admission of humiliation.
The only way to redeem myself is to stand at your side.
Sowheel nodded, did his best to shrug away the clamor of adolescent embarrassment, and to comport himself as a man,
as a king of a proud people. Saranga ut Ngonkakal, the future Sadakan of High Holy Zeum, was at once apologizing, which was remarkable in and of itself, and begging the most profound of favors, a means of recovering his honor, and so securing the fate of his immortal soul. The young king of Sakarpus offered up his hand, palm up, with his index finger alone extended, one boonsman to another.
Saranga frowned and smiled. What is this? You want me to smell it?
No, Zorwil stammered. No, we call it the Vernoral. Fingerlock, you would say. It is a pledge of unity, a way to say that henceforth all your battles will be my battles.
You sausages, the successor prince said, clasping his entire hand within the warm bowl of his own.
Come, our mighty general wishes to see you.
Sowheel crouched next to his slave before following Saranga outside.
I can speak to you now, he said in Shaik, hoping this might elicit some flicker of passion. But the old Shigeki merely regarded him with the same grieved lack of comprehension, as if he had forgotten Shaik as promptly as Sowheel had learned it.
More importantly, he added before stepping clear of the cloistered heat, I can listen. Arid sunlight seemed to shower the whole of creation, so bright he stumbled for squinting. He stood at the tent threshold, blinking the liquid from the glare, until the world finally resolved into parched vistas. The camp, the crowded tents and grand pavilions, bleached of color for brightness, and the horror that encircled it. Swales of blackening dead humped and pitted the distances, shrank and more shrank, teeth hanging spitless about gaping maws, eyes fogged, heaped into an endless array of macabre deadfalls. Limbs predominated in certain places, piled like the sticks Saglanders brought to market to sell as kindle. Heads and torsos prevailed in others, cobbled into mounds that resembled stacks of rotting fish. Great smears of black scored the far-flung mats, where the witches had burned their countless thousands. They reminded him of the charcoal grounds to the south of Sakarpus, only with bodies instead of trees, charred to stump anonymity. These marked the greatest concentrations of dead. The reek struck too deep to be smelled. It could only be breathed. The sight unsettled him, not for the grisly detail, but because of the preposterous scale. He wanted to rejoice, for it seemed that was what a true son of Sarkarpus should do, seeing their ancestral foe laid out to the horizon. But he could not. Breathing the carrion wind, glancing across the carcass heights, he found himself mourning. Not for the Shrank, whose obscenity blocked all possibility of compassion, but for the innocence of a world that had never seen such sights. For the boy he had been before awakening.
Even if I survive, Saranga said from his side, none will believe me when I return.
We must make sure you die, then, Sowheel replied. The successor prince smirked without a worried glance. They trekked on in awkward silence, sorting through industrious clouds of Enrithi, wending down tented alleys. Barely every man Sorweel glimpsed bore some sign of the previous night's battle, whether it be bandages clotted about appalling wounds, or the divided stares of those trying to stumble clear of memories of violence and fury. Many seemed to recognize him, and some even lowered their faces in accordance, he imagined, with some precept of Jeannine, the arcane etiquette of the Three Seas. The awkward transformation of his relationship with Zaranga, he realized, with no little dismay, was but the beginning of the changes his thoughtless courage had wrought. Courage, it seemed such a foolish word. Naught but the scribble of a child, compared to the lunacy of the previous night. When he dared glimpse his memories, he suffered only the crowding of dread and terror. He felt a coward, looking back, so laughably far from the hero Zaranga was making of him. A mob of caste nobles and Kidrahil officers milled about the entrance to Kaodas's command tent, and Sorweel simply assumed that he and Zaranga would be forced to while away the watches in listless conversation. But faces turned to regard them as they approached, across the outer rind of warriors at first, then deeper as word of their arrival passed from lip to lip. The rumble of conversations evaporated. Sorweel and Zaranga found themselves standing dumbfounded before their accumulated gazes. "Huostra cum de foul bewaren mersa!" a towering long-beard cried from the assembly's midst. The man shouldered his way through the others, his eyes bright with a kind of vicious joy. "Sorweel Veritshaw," he bellowed, seizing him in a great black-armored embrace. "Famfolic kusktasa!" Suddenly everyone was cheering, and the young king found himself thrust into the crowd's congratulatory heart, shaking hands, returning embraces, nodding and thanking strangers with a kind of witless, breathless confusion. He acknowledged face after bruised face, even hugged a man blindfolded with bandages. In a matter of heartbeats he was delivered to the command tent, where he fairly tripped past the Polarian guards, and into the washed light of the interior, so flustered that it seemed a minor miracle that he remembered to fall to his knees. "She positions you," Anasarimber Kaoudis watched him from his chair, obviously amused by the spectacle of his arrival. Even in his Kidrahil cuirass and mail skirts, he sat with feline repose, his sandaled feet stretched across the mats before him, watching with the remote, lolling manner of an opium-eater. Sorweel knew instantly that the man had not slept, and that he would not be the worse for it. The air was stifling, as much for the sunlight that frosted the canvas ceiling as for all the exhaling mouths. 5 scribes crowded the sheaf-laden table to his right, and numerous others stood milling in what little space remained, officers and caste nobles for the most part. Sorweel saw Escalies among them, decked in his crimson mandate robes, his left eye swollen into a greasy purple crease. He had glimpsed Anasarimber Serwa, standing as tall as many of the men, swan-like in gowns of embroidered white. A memory of her arcane embrace whispered through him. Kaoudis allowed the uproar to subside before gesturing for him to stand. The Prince Imperial was not long in waiting. Something immaculate in his manner seemed to cut against all things unruly. "Teus Escalies has told us everything," he declared. "You have saved us, Sorweel. You!" A broken chorus of cheers and shouts arose from those gathered within the tent. "I did nothing," the Sekarpi king replied, trying to avoid the Swayali Grand Mistress's gaze. "Nothing?" The Kidrahil general frowned, scratched the flax and plates of his beard. "You read the signs like a true son of the plains. You saw the doom our foe had prepared for us. You counseled your commander to take the only action that could save us. And then, in the moment of utmost crisis, you lent your shoulder to Escalies, cast your life on the longest odds, so that he might alert us." He glanced up toward his sister, then looked back, grinning like an uncle trying to teach his nephew how to gamble. "Nothing has ever been so impressive. I did only what I thought sensible." "Sense?" Kaoudis said with scowling good nature. "There are as many sensibilities as there are passions, Sorweel. Terror has a sense all its own, flee, shirk, abandon, whatever it takes to carry away one's skin. But you, you answer to that sense that transcends base desire. And we stand before you, breathing, victorious, as a result. The Sicarpi King glanced about wildly, convinced that he was the butt of some cruel joke. But everyone assembled watched with a kind of indulgent expectation, as if understanding he was but a boy still, unused to the burden of communal accolades. Only Zaranga's solitary black face betrayed worry.
I know not what to say. You honor me.
The Prince Imperial nodded with a wisdom that belied the adolescent tenderness of his beard.
That is my intent, he said.
I have even sent a party of crippled riders back to Sarkarpus to bear word of your heroic role to your kinsmen.
You what?
Sorweel fairly coughed. It's a political gesture, I admit, but the glory is no less real. In his soul's eye, Sorweel could see a racked line of Kidrahill filing through the ruins of the Herder's Gate, outland conquerors, oppressors, crying out the treachery of Harweel's only son, how he had saved the very host that had laid Sarkarpus low. Nausea welled through him. Shame squirmed in his breast, clawing his ribs, scratching his heart.
I don't know what to say, he stammered.
You need not say anything, Caiutus said with an indulgent smile. Your pride is clear for all to see.
She is hiding you.
And for the first time he felt it, the impurity of standing unseen. He had stood before Anna Serimber Caiutus before. He had suffered his raking gaze. He knew what it meant to be known by an enemy, to have his fears counted, his vengeful aspirations reckoned, and so transformed into levers that could be used against him. Now he felt as if he were peeking at the man through his mother's shielding fingers, at his cheeks, stung for the memory of Porsperian rubbing Yatwer spit into them. "I've had you entered into the lists as the new captain of the Scions," Caiutus continued. "Disbanded they may be, but their honor will be yours. We were fortunate that Zerodus Harnilus possessed wisdom enough to recognize your sense. I will not trust fortune to so favor us a second time. Henceforth, you will attend me and my staff, and you will be accorded all the glory and privilege that belongs to a believer king." She had placed him here, the dread mother of birth. Was the courage even his? It seemed an important question, but then the legends seemed littered with the confusion of heroes and the gods that favored them. Perhaps his hand simply was her hand. He recoiled from the thought.
"May I beg one boon?"
A flicker of mild surprise.
"Of course."
"Zaranga, I would have him accompany me if I could." Caiutus scowled, and several onlookers exchanged not-so-discreet whispers. For perhaps the first time the Sicarpi King understood his friend's importance to the Ennis Arimber. Of all the world's remaining nations, only Zayim posed a credible threat to the new empire. "You know that he conspires against us," the Prince Imperial said, switching to effortless Sicarpic. Suddenly the two of them stood alone in a room walled with strangers.
"I have my fears," Sorweel began, lying smoothly.
But what?
"He no longer doubts the truth of your father's war. No one does."
The implication was clear as it was surprising, for in all his life Sorweel had never counted his among devious souls. The first son of Ngakakau wavered. To bring him into the Prince Imperial's retinue could be the very thing his conversion required. And that, Sorweel suddenly realized, was the Aspect Emperor's goal, to have a believer become a Satakan.
"Granted," Caiutus said, switching to the dismissive air of men who scarce had time for accommodations.
He made a two-fingered gesture to one of his scribes, who began fingering through sheaves of vellum. "But I fear you have one last duty to discharge," the general said in Shaik, just as Sorweel glanced about for some cue that the audience had ended.
"A mortal one."
The omnipresent smell of rot seemed to take on a sinister tang.
"My arm is your arm, Lord General."
This reply occasioned a heartbeat of scrutiny.
"The great ordeal has all but exhausted its supplies. We starve, Sorweel. We have too many mouths and too little food. The time has come to put certain mouths to the knife."
Sorweel swallowed, against a sudden pang in his breast.
"What are you saying? You must put down your slave, Porsparian, in accordance with my father's edict."
"I must what?" he asked, blinking. So there was a joke after all.
"You must kill your slave before sunrise tomorrow, or your life will be forfeit,"
Ceuta said, speaking in a tone as much directed to the assembled caste nobles as to the believer king standing before him. "Even heroes," he was saying, "must answer to our holy Aspect Emperor.
Do you understand?"
"Yes," Sorweel replied, speaking with a determination utterly at odds with the tumult that was his soul. He understood. He was alone, a captive in the host of his enemy. He would do whatever. Kill whomever.
Chosen by the gods.
Anything to see the Aspect Emperor dead and his father avenged. Sorweel returned to his tent alone, his back still warm for all the slapping, his ears still hot with the chorus of overwrought acclaim. Porsparian stood before the entrance, forlorn and emaciated, and as motionless as a sentinel. The sight fairly winded the young king.
"Follow me,"
he told the man, his gaze scratched with incredulity. The old Shigeki slave regarded him with a momentary squint. Then, without worry or even curiosity, he struck out ahead of his master, leading him into the fields of rotting shrank. Sorweel could only gape at the sight. A little nut-brown man, walking stooped, his limbs bowed as if bent to the bundle of his many years, picking his way across the packed dead. So the slave led the king, and perhaps this was how it should have been, given the way Sorweel felt himself dwindle with every step. He could scarce believe what he was about to do. Execution. When he forced himself to confront the prospect, his body and soul rebelled the way he had once feared they would in the thick of battle. The lightness of the hands, the starlings battling in his gut, loosening his bowel, the wires that hooked his head and shoulders into a pose just shy of a cringe, the incessant murmur of dread. Men often find themselves stranded in circumstance, stumbling toward goals not of their making, surrounded by absurdities they can scarce believe. They assume the little continuities that characterize their moments will carry them through their entire lives. They forget the volatility of the whole, the way tribes and nations trip like drunks through history. They forget that fate is a whore. Porsparian hobbled ahead, picking a path through the carapace of dead. Sorweel quickly lost sight of the camp behind the blood-slick mounds. When he looked out, death and far-flung rot were all he could see. Shrank. When he glimpsed them in fragments, a face nestled in the crook of an arm, a hand hanging from a raised wrist, they almost seemed human. When he gazed across them en masse, they seemed the issue of a drained sea. As bad as it had been in the camp, the reek welled palpable from the sweating tangle, to the point where coughing and gagging became one and the same, until smell became a taste that seemed to hang against the skin, an odor that could be licked. Ravens made summits of skulls, jumped from crown to crown, spearing eye sockets. Vultures hunched and squabbled over individual spoils, even though all was carrion. The whine of flies was multiplied until it became a singular hum. Porsparian walked, and he nimbly followed, at times skidding across offal, or wincing at the crack of ribbed hollows beneath his boots. He alternately found himself studying the Shigeki slave, his shoulders crooked about hard, huffing breaths, and avoiding all sight of him. He knew now that he had deceived himself, that he had failed to press the enigmatic man for answers out of fear, and not because the intricacies of Shaik defeated him. He had reacted not as a man, but as a little boy, embracing the childish instinct to skulk and to avoid, to besiege fact with cowardly pretense. All this time they could not speak, and so were strangers, each perhaps as frightful to the other. And now, when he could finally ask, finally discover what madness the dread mother had prepared for him, he had to kill the little priest, Saranga had called him. His slave, Porsparian. Sorweel paused, suddenly understanding Zaranga's cryptic tone when he asked him about Obutegua. He had been thinking of the Aspect Emperor's edict, the very edict behind the crime Sorweel was about to commit. If he himself balked at the prospect of murdering a terrifying stranger, what would it be like for Zaranga to put down a beloved childhood companion, a surrogate father even? Perhaps it was for the best that the Istuli swallow the wise old man whole, that Obutegua stumble into a small pile of human rubble, cloth and scattered bones, marking nothing. Sorweel found himself blinking at the slave's form, laboring through carrion ravines. "Porsparian!" he called, coughing against the stench. The old man ignored him. A clutch of ravens cried out in his stead, their calls like a small army of flies, scraping edges of tin. "Porsparian, stop!"
"Not there yet,"
the man hacked over his shoulder.
"Not where?" Sorweel cried, hastening after his agile slave.
Bones popped in stiffening meat. Arrow shafts cracked. What was the man doing? What was his manner of fleeing?
"Porsparian, look! I'm not going to kill you."
"What happens to me is not important,"
the Shaggeki wheezed. Sorweel suffered dim memories of his grandfather in his final shameful days, how he had taken to willful and insensible acts, if only to answer some prideful instinct to do.
"Porsparian," he said, at last seizing the man's bony shoulder. He was going to tell the man that he could run, that he was free to risk the open plains, perhaps trust in the goddess to deliver him. But instead he released the man, shocked by the immediacy of the bones beneath his tunic. By the sheer ease he had yanked him about, as if the man were naught but a doll, pigskin wrapped about desert dry wood. When had he last eaten?
Cursing in some harsh tongue, the slave resumed his senseless trek, and Sorweel stood, absorbing the realization that Porsparian would not survive on the plains, that to set him free was simply to condemn him to a slower, far more miserable demise. That anything short of execution would be an act of cowardice. A moment of madness ensued, one which Sorweel would remember for the rest of his life. He choked on a scream that was a laugh, that was a sob, that was a father's soothing whisper. A kind of macabre intensity bubbled up out of his surroundings, an inversion of seeing, so that the jutting spears and the innumerable arrow shafts that stubbled the summits of dead pinned and staked his skin. The foggy glare of hundreds from limb-thatched burrows, the tongues like hanging snails, the entrails spilling from shells of armor, drying into papyrus. "She is positioning you."
"How?"
"As mad as it sounds, I really have come to save mankind."
"What? Father?
And then he saw it, standing with the grace and proportion of any Nani vase, regarding him, the knife of its long beak folded against its neck. A stork, perched upon purpling dead, as though upon a promontory of high stone, its snowy edges framed by bleached sky. And he was racing after the diminutive slave, tripping and skidding.
"What's going on?" he cried, seizing the man. "You will tell me."
The rutted face betrayed no surprise, no anger, or fear whatsoever.
"Pollution has seized the hearts of men," the slave rasped. "The mother prepares our cleansing."
The slave raised warm fingers to Sorweel's wrists, gently tugged his hands from his shoulders.
"And all this is deception. Deception!"
Sorweel stumbled. So placid had Porsperian seemed, and such was the fury of his barked reply.
So his war,
the Sicarpi king stammered.
"He is a demon who wears men the way we don clothes."
"But his war!" He scraped his gaze across and tossed the tangled carcasses about them.
"It is real!"
Porsperian snorted.
"All is false, and all who follow him are damned. But his war, Porsperian, look around you, and tell me this war is not real." "What? Because he sent his followers against the Shrank? The world is filled with Shrank."
"And what of the Consult Legion, the Shrank who killed my comrades?"
"Lies! Lies!"
"How can you know?"
"I know nothing. I speak."
And with that he resumed his bandy march into the dead. The slave picked his way across a swale of blasted and blackened Shrank, and into a region of sorcerous destruction. In his soul's eye the young king could see the Swayali witch hanging a hard stone's throw above, a slender beauty aglow in the curlicue bloom of her billows, dispensing lines and sheets of cutting light. He shook his head at the vision.
"Porsperian!"
The little man ignored him, though he did slow his pace. He peered downward as he walked, looking this way and that, as if searching for a lost Kellick.
"Tell me," Sorweel cried out, his wonder giving way to irritation. "Tell me what she wants."
"A mighty lord died here," he heard the man mutter.
"Yatwer,"
the Sicarpi king cried, throwing the name like a cold and heavy stone from his breast. "What does she want of me?"
"Here," the old man's voice was thick with a kind of unsavory relish, "beneath the skinnies."
Sorweel stood dumbfounded, watching the mad fool heave at the burnt Shrank thatched beneath his feet.
"The earth,"
he grunted, tossing aside an arm and attached shoulder,
"must uncover."
The Sicarpi king gazed witless. When they had set out, he could scarce look at Porsperian without flinching from the madness of what he had to do. But the Shigeki slave seemed to care not in the least, even though he had to know he was doomed. Not in the least, Sorweel followed him out here into Carrion to cut his throat, and the man acted as if this were but a trifling compared to what he— Cold flushed through and about the young man. He found himself casting wild looks across the surrounding dead, as if he were a murderer suddenly unsure of the secrecy of his crime. The goddess. The king bent his back and joined the slave in his grisly labor. The forms were uniformly burned. Many of them possessed cauterized slices. Amputations. He cleared two that had lost their legs, one at the hips, the other high on the thigh, as if they'd been felled side by side, reaved as if by a single scythe. Where those on top had been mostly scorched to husks, those below remained primarily raw and wet. Their eyes glared out with an aimless, smoky curiosity. Not knowing what the man intended, Sorweel simply grabbed the carcasses adjacent to those his slave wrenched into sunlight. He cast hooded looks over his shoulders. He found himself troubled by the weight of the creatures, the way their scrawniness belied a brute density. The corpses became colder as the toil continued. They found the earth sodden with filth, puddled. They gasped for their effort, gagged for the stench they had unleashed. Sorweel watched Porsperian fall to his knees, in the heart of the muck oval they had cleared. A grave dug from the dead. He watched him raise and kiss the polluted earth. The wind tousled the king's lengthening hair, tumbled across all visible creation, troubling the emanations. The flies hummed undisturbed, Ravens punctuated the distance with random cries. He watched his slaves scallop muck clear, glimpsed a skull unearthed beneath the shadow of his hands. Peering, he willed himself to breathe through his horror. He watched the man gather putrid mud, then mold a face about the bone, all the while murmuring prayers in some harsh and exotic tongue. Then he watched as he skinned a shrank face with terrifying economy, watched him pad the result across the earthen face he had prepared for it. The king experienced something outside horror or exultation. He watched his slave stroke and caress the slick surfaces, forehead, brow, lip, cheek. He watched, and he listened, until the rasp that was the slave's prayer became a drifting smoke that obscured all other sound. He watched life, impossible life, rise into the inhuman skin. He watched Yatwar's eyes snap open. He heard the groan of the earth. The goddess smiles. The old man crouches over her, frozen like a man caught in a commission of some obscenity. Something shivers through the hideous earth. Scabrous arms burst from the soil to either side. Clotted bones, knotted worms. The slave stumbles back, staggers into the clutch of the horrified king. They watch the goddess exhume her own corpse. She trowels away muck and viscous slop, reveals the ivory comb of her ribs. She reaches into her muddy abdomen, excavates her cadaverous womb. The very ground croaks and groans beneath them, the complaint of some cosmological hinge, existence, pried too far from its essential frame. She draws a pouch from the pit below her stomach, raises it pinched in fingers of filth and bone. She smiles. Tears of blood stream from her earthen eyes. The watching men gasp for the sorrow of a mother's endless giving. So many children born, so many taken. The king trips to his knees. He crawls forward to receive her gift, crawls with the shame of an inconstant son. He snatches the pouch as if from a leper. It lies stiff and cold in his fingers, like a dead man's tongue. He scarcely sees it for his mother's dirt glare. He looks back to the slave, who sobs for joy and horror. He turns back to his goddess. But she is no more. Nothing but a grotesque face, a monstrosity molded above an overturned grave. "What just happened?" the king cries to the slave. "What just happened?" The slave says nothing. He climbs to his feet, hobbles from the macabre clearing, back into the dead, with an invalid's gait. He stumbles up a slope of pitched carcasses. He pauses before a spear that juts from the buzzing summit. The king calls out to him, beseeching. The slave places his chin upon the spear point, lifts his hands high in heavenly supplication. "What the mother gives," he cries out to the king, "you must take." He smiles fleetingly, as if regretting things both inevitable and criminal. Then Porsperian Nesh Feralti drops. He never reaches his knees. He hangs, rather, from the inside crown of his skull, that slowly tips to his side. He seems to vanish among the strewn forms. One more dead skinny. The king of Sarkarpis staggered back alone, trudging across mad ways of the dead. Saranga was waiting for him when he returned. Neither man had any words to speak, so they simply sat side by side in the dust, staring into their hands. Saranga was the first to break their fast of silence. He clasped his friend's shoulder and said, "Things done are done." Sorwill did not reply. Each of them gazed into his own absent direction, like dogs leashed to the shade. They watched the endless to and fro of warlike men across and between the tents. The army of the Middle North. They watched the dust devils spinning in and out of faint existence between the innumerable pennants and banners.
"Did he tell you?" Saranga asked. "Your little priest. Did he tell you what...
what she wants?" Sorweel turned to regard his friend with a wide and wary glare. He knew he could trust the man, with his life if need be, and this comforted him in a way he had never known. Saranga was a true boonsman, but he also knew that he could not trust his face, that he could not risk anything for the shadows of the Enesarimber would glimpse within him.
"Yes," he replied, looking back to the men of the ordeal. "What is done is done."
When the successor prince finally departed, Sorweel retreated from the setting sun into the gloom of his tent. He pulled the pouch from his belt. The muck had dried to ash about its edges. He brushed it away with trembling fingers, noticing for the first time the dizzying patterns burned into the age-old leather. Crescents. Crescents within crescents. Broken circles, he decided, glimpsing the gold-thread circumfixes embroidered along the hem of his own tunic. Broken circumfixes. He tugged free the clip of chapped bronze that held its mouth closed. He already knew what it contained, for as king of Sarcarpus, he was also high keeper of the hoard. Nevertheless, he tipped the pouch so that he might hold it in his calloused palm. A sphere of ancient iron. A core. A holy tear of God.